Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, September 4th, 2009, I am delighted to welcome longtime San Francisco Bay Area newsman, who is Vice President and News Director at CBS 5 KPIX TV, Dan Rosenheim. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Great. Hey, I have to ask you about a couple of stories that touch on your background in the news industry. One is the headline today that the Chicago Tribune is reporting that the Chicago Sun-Times might be rescued from Chapter 11 by an investor group led by businessman Jim Tyree. What do you make of that?
Well, I hadn't seen that report. I worked for both the Tribune and Sun-Times in the early 1980s before I came out here. And, newspapers everywhere, both of those papers have had a difficult time of it in recent years. The Tribune, of course, was sold. It was owned by Tribune Company for many years and was sold to a local real estate developer who, within a fairly short period of time, put the company under bankruptcy protection. They just sold the Chicago Cubs. They're trying to figure out how to make the Tribune profitable. And the Sun-Times, which has been historically the number two paper in the city in circulation and has a reputation as a feisty city tabloid, has had financial difficulties for a long time. It was sold by Marshall Field in 1984 to Rupert Murdoch, and Murdoch held it for a while, and then it's gone through a whole series of different owners. And there's been a great deal of speculation about whether the Sun-Times can continue to publish and whether Chicago can support two regular print daily newspapers in that have traditional form. So, as I say, I don't know the specifics of this morning's report, but I guess it's more turbulence in the Chicago newspaper market and for newspapers in general.
Yeah, and I guess what strikes me when I read this, you know, having a background for a long time in journalism, is that, as you said, you know, it was formerly, or I guess it technically is still owned by a real estate developer, but now a businessman might come in and own it. And we're seeing really non-traditional ownership start to take form as a pretty regular practice of papers.
Well, I guess it's non-traditional. I mean, when you think back to the ownership of newspapers as they developed in the 19th and early 20th centuries, they were pretty much held by people who, at least in some cases, by people who were very dedicated just to the newspaper itself. That was certainly the case of the San Francisco Chronicle, which was founded by the DeYoung brothers here. Having said that, they were business undertakings. They were seen as a way to make money. They made vast fortunes for people like the Hearsts and indeed the McCormicks. And I'm not sure, you know, I think it's really in the latter part of the 20th century that newspapers became publicly owned by large media companies like Tribune Company or Knight Ridder or New York Times. So now maybe we're more reverting to form with privately held companies under the sway of an individual business person. I think in some cases, business people have gone into the newspaper industry in the last 10 years, have made purchases of struggling papers, thinking that they'd be able to find a way out. And once they got in, they found that the situation was much more difficult economically than they anticipated. That's certainly the case for Sam Zell, the guy who bought the Tribune, who said, he had no idea that things were as bad as they turned out to be when he got in.
And there's
a lot of talk that even if he remains the titular owner, that he's going to bow out in terms of any oversight role for that company.
Interesting. You know, another thing I think is fascinating is when people talk about Chicago, you know, with Obama's ascension into the White House, a lot of people have, you know, put a lot of attention on Chicago. And yet you see this sort of struggle, you know, the Tribune reporting on what's happening at the Sun-Times. And, you know, it's sort of sad in a way, but it's interesting, too, that you know, this sort of popular culture thought might be that newspaper readership could potentially be up. But really that's not been the case, which I guess for the kind of campaign Obama ran, that's not that shocking.
Yeah, I mean, I think circulation for newspapers may have blips here and there, but there's a long-term, I think what the economists call a secular trend, with the growing diversification of news sources and the proliferation of news sources, the secular trend is down. And this has been occurring over really a couple of decades that we've seen circulation decline. And if anything, it's accelerated in the last couple of years. Chicago's a terrific news town. It's always been a terrific news town. It generates a lot of news. It has a big appetite for news. It's a, you know the reputation. Certainly in terms of city politics, it's a brawling town. And so I don't think that has changed, and it may well be that all the excitement over the Obama election caused some little bump, temporary bump in circulation last year, but not enough to reverse the long-term decline in the number of people who are willing to buy a newspaper every day, and that of course translates into fewer advertising dollars because it's a less effective vehicle for advertisers to reach people.
So, not in addition to being in the Chicago market, and we can hear the past as the economic and financial writer in your comments just now. What did you make of the Examiner's purchase of this so-called citizen journalism site, Now Public, earlier this week?
Well, I think the Examiner, like everyone else, is trying to figure out the combination of platforms that will allow it to succeed. And, what the Examiner's done is really not very different from what all sorts of traditional news organizations have done, whether they are growing their own websites, whether they are looking to other platforms, in the case of TV, for example, considering using digital subcarrier channels as a way of providing news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, or providing weather anytime you need it, whether they are buying new organizations like CBS Corporation's decision to buy CNET a year ago. And we're all looking for different outlets and ways of reaching an audience that increasingly knows it can get the news it wants when it wants it, and we need to find a way to be responsive. And a newspaper that operates on a print cycle and home delivers or sells in a newsstand, or for that matter, a television newscast that comes on every day at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, is probably in the long run not in and of itself a vehicle that is, well, they're not areas where there's going to be a lot of growth. Let me put it that way.
Right. Does it concern you, though, as you know, someone who's, I think you're a fellow at the Knight Ritter Center for Digital Journalism or something like that. I'm sorry. I'm trying to remember what it was, what your role.
Well, I don't have any continuing role there. The Knight Foundation funds a program both at UC Berkeley and at the University of Southern California in digital media. And there was a week-long seminar earlier this year, which they called a digital media seminar, which is actually an opportunity to get training in various kinds of equipment. And we sent four members of our station there to work with very lightweight, high-def cameras and various kinds of editing and experimenting with, for people who weren't used to writing, doing writing, and people who weren't used to shooting, doing shooting. And I decided to go because we're looking at expanding traditional job definitions among our staff, and I thought I ought to have some hands-on experience with how that process of training takes place. That's all that was.
Which is why I think that you're so smart in terms of, you know, especially the local, you know, the local scene in terms of news directors who really have a sense of the tide is shifting, where do I need to be to kind of understand, you know, where the change is happening so that I can plan appropriately for it, which makes me also ask you, you know, in a sense, you know, when I think about, you know, a site like or a newspaper like The Examiner purchasing something like Now Public and this idea of citizen journalism, do you worry about the dilution of, you know, journalism with a capital J, as some people call it, you know, particularly in a local market where you worry about the validity and integrity of our news products.
Sure, you worry about that. Traditionally, journalism in this country has been flawed and has had biases and has had problems, but it's been practiced by people who are trained and experienced in the craft and by and large have a shared set of values that include things like accuracy and timeliness and accountability and accessibility. And these are things that most traditional news organizations feel that you ought to have, as well as balance. I think the proliferation of new news sources is a mixed bag. It obviously provides lots more information in lots of different ways to people, and that's a terrific thing. And it can be a wonderful thing for a democracy and for forces that support democracy. And an example, I think, of that is the use of social media by people in Iran following the election earlier this year. And the impact that had, and it remains to be seen what the impact will be on the course of events in Iran, but it clearly did have an influence on the regime, for better or for worse, and certainly an influence on world understanding and public opinion. So in that respect, more news is good news. But at the same time, I think there's an important role played by people who practice the craft. And who are trained to who belong to organizations that are willing to invest the time and the money needed to peel back the layers of the onion on complex issues, to do investigations, to hold public officials accountable, to look into complex issues and try to illuminate them in ways that public understanding is raised. And traditionally, that's a role that newspapers in this country have played to a significant degree, and to some degree, television has played. And I worry a great deal that as traditional news organizations reduce their discretionary, what they might consider their discretionary spending on that form of journalism, and emphasize more and more basic reporting done by staffs that may be less experienced in reporting that's less expensive, that there is a cost to our society in terms of our understanding. And I also think I would add to that traditionally having a relatively small number of television stations and a relatively small number of newspapers has meant that we collectively as citizens in an area have kind of a shared frame of reference. We all historically have read the San Francisco Chronicle or the San Jose Mercury News or the Oakland Tribune. Large numbers of us have. So our sense of what the news agenda is facing our society and our common sense of what events are taking place and what people are changing the direction of events in our society is shaped by, there's a shared understanding that comes from all of us experiencing the same media. And if we're all getting our news from lots of different sources, you can argue that there'll be an enriching aspect to that, and I think that's true, but I think you lose a certain sense of community and a certain shared understanding of what the issues are that count.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, among some of the business leaders that I speak to who are trying to figure this social media thing out, you know, it's sort of, who do you trust? Who do you go to? It reminds me of when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Turkmenistan, frankly, and, you know, them, you know, people, especially Russians, coming up to you and explaining that, you know, having choice in supermarkets, or even when I was a kid and the wall fell and, you know, there was suddenly democracy in Russia. And you know, we saw Germany trying to bring itself back together, that this idea of choice is not a good thing because it leads to confusion.
I'm not suggesting that choice is a bad thing at all. But I'm saying that I think we need to be mindful that we're at risk of losing something. We're at risk of losing a shared perception, a shared understanding, and some would argue that that shared thing is bad. News media are evil corporate oligarchs who have very limited report news within a very limited framework and shape the news with the same basic assumptions. And if people aren't free to think more creatively about social issues because the media are so limiting. So there's a strong argument that the proliferation of sources is a good thing, but I think you've given something up, and we need to see how we're going to support economically the kinds of reporting that traditional news organizations have done in the past that take extra time and extra digging and extra training and experience. Because if we lose that, then I think we lose something really important. I think, you know, you look at the reports out of the Washington Press Corps today, and it's a more diverse press corps, and in some ways that's a very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there are fewer traditional news organizations that have their own people in Washington, and there's more generic reporting coming out of Washington that's going to traditional news media. And so I think there's a watering down effect that takes place at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to mischaracterize your comments, I was sort of referring to the folks that I've spoken to, you know, that are, you know, part of the business community in San Francisco that are sort of trying to figure things out. And, the people that I have met, there are groups, strong contingents that I find sometimes surprisingly are confused about where, you know, what a good news information source is these days. And they will ask me, you know,
right,
who do you trust? Who, you know, who influences you? Because certainly the Iran election was a great example. But when you come down to it, I'm on the board of the Social Media Club, for example, and we do a question of the week, and we asked ourselves that question. You know, do you trust a report that's just, if, for example, if you're following Twitter, do you follow just a tweet, or does it need to have a link from the BBC, or does it need to have a link from CNN or CBS or some other, you know, well-founded news organization for you to really believe what the report is telling you?
Mm-hmm. In a way, it puts an onus on the consumer to be more thoughtful, more skeptical, to shop at more than one place. You know, so if you see something on a tweet, if you're following a particular tweet and there's information there, you want to confirm it somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you don't know as much about the source as you might historically. On the other
yeah.
hand, it may give you information that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Yeah, I think context is always a good thing. But, you know, I think, when I think about my ethics professors at Columbia School of Journalism, I think some of them would probably roll over in their collective graves over some of what's happening right now. Those that I'm lucky enough to still be in touch with, you know, we talk about this kind of thing all the time.
Right.
One of the things that we talk about is whether the decline of local newspapers, which you've identified, as a trend, obviously an undeniable one, is an opportunity in some way for local TV news.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think if local newspapers were declining and the problems were specific to local newspapers, it would clearly be an opportunity, but it's a more complex situation because the underlying factors are not that different for television news. The decline of local newspapers has been more dramatic in the last couple of years, and I think we know why. Very specifically, we can say a big factor has been the development of websites like Craigslist that have
mm-hmm.
taken classified advertising out of newspapers, and in many newspapers classified accounted for 50% of their revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the three major categories of classified traditionally have been help wanted, jobs wanted, and real estate, and nobody goes to newspapers anymore for that. Very few
mm-hmm.
people do. They go to Craigslist.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a panel with Craig once, and the poor guy, he gets blamed so much. People say to him, it's your fault that newspapers are crashing. Well,
some of the sex scandal type. Well,
that's a whole
thing.
Different issue. Yeah.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, seeing him on the cover of Wired, it all weighs on him. You know,
right.
I think
it does weigh on him,
do
and my sense is that
right
he's somebody who has a very strong sense of ethics and takes it very seriously. And clearly,
yes,
if he had invented Craigslist, someone else would have.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, the decline the precipitous decline of classified has contributed to a crisis in the newspaper industry that has been higher profile than the difficulties experienced in television. But the television news business faces the same long-term problem, which is that there has been a proliferation of sources of news that's making the individual slices of the pie we all have smaller and harder for us to make a profit. And when I grew up in Chicago, there were three or four TV stations for news, and each of them, three of them had belonged to networks, and there was network news, and that was your source of national news in terms of broadcast, and that's it. And obviously, since then, we have not only the development of CNN and Fox and MSNBC, but also all the specialized channels, the sports channels. My, you know, my kids are tremendous sports fans, and but I've never seen them say, let's stick around and watch the 11 o'clock news on Channel 5 to see the sports report, because they go right to ESPN. And watch baseball tonight.
Or Comcast Sportsnet that's just spending
Comcast, or Comcast Sportsnet, which now does local sports. That's right. So, and it's not just the sports channel. It's the tennis channel and the golf channel and the weather channel and the home and garden channel and you name it. And each one of those things, each has eroded the near hegemonic position that television news once had. It's not to say that television news has no appeal anymore. It still attracts a very sizable audience, and is still a very good business proposition, but it's a shrinking audience. And that's just because of the growth of cable. Then you throw in the internet, and the experience people have of a nonlinear medium, so they don't have to sit and watch a half hour or an hour of television that's linear. You have no choice over how long a story lasts or what comes up next. You click around and you watch the video you want when you want it, and you go back and forth between text and video. As you know, you read the text thumbnails, and if you want to see the video, you watch the video. When you're tired, it's like watching TV the way you read a newspaper. When you pick up a newspaper, you can start in the business section if you want, or you can start on page one, and there's seven stories on page one, and you can pick the one you want. And when you get bored, you can switch to another one. TV isn't like that. TV is linear. It's one story follows another at a predetermined speed, and there's no user control. And I think in a world where users have control over the information they get, it gets harder to absorb news on TV. So interestingly, television viewing overall, for better or for worse, is at an all-time high. Never in our history have more people watched television, but television news viewing specifically is down and is declining. So that long-winded answer to your question is, yeah, I think there are opportunities for us, for broadcasters. The whole field of news media is recasting itself and is transforming itself very rapidly and very radically, and that's creating opportunities for us. But it's not as though newspapers are the only guys who have problems. We have problems too, and we have to solve those problems. And we either have to offer television content that's so good and so distinct and so value-added that people will watch it on TV, or we have to come up with ways to take the content gathering apparatus we have and provide news for different platforms so that we can have more than one revenue stream and can afford to have the kind of news operation we've traditionally grown accustomed to. Because we're talking a a newspaper with 300 or 400 or 500 editorial people, or a TV station with 100 or 200 or 250 editorial people, and as the revenue stream shrinks, you can't afford that many people, and you lay people off, which indeed we had to do a year ago, and which the Chronicles had to do repeatedly.
Right. I think, you know, one of the things I think about is obviously the automotive industry, you know, in particular, has been one of, at least, you know, my experience in television news has been that that was sort of one of the bread and butter industries. And I wonder if that's impacted greatly revenue, you know, one of the main revenue sources for your television station.
Yeah, it has had an impact, particularly in the last year. Auto, you know, I'm not in the sales department. The sales guys tell me that auto advertising is starting to come back. And I'm seeing a little more on TV, and I'm seeing a little more in the newspapers. And it, just as the economy apparently is starting slowly to come back. You know, what's happened in Detroit and what's happened to car sales in general in the last year has had a big impact on our advertising revenue, because the auto industry has virtually stopped advertising for a while. And when they come back, even in good times, they now have the opportunity to advertise in a large number of media rather than a small number. So, again, the trend is toward spreading the advertising dollar around more. We still do very well in that area. We're still a very good vehicle for automobile advertising, but we have a lot more competition for those dollars.
One of the things I think about when I think about social media, and I'll ask you about some of those channels that you're using in a minute, because I think that you at CBS5.com, you guys have done a lot of sort of innovative things early on to be there for the audience wherever they want you, actually, and people may not realize that. But before we sort of get there, I want to ask you, there's, you know, obviously this piece of the internet, especially I think among Generation X of, personal branding. And I think about what some have criticized as the sort of celebritization of news, which was around TV media when I worked in TV media, especially in the earlier 2000s and in late 90s, when people would say, "Oh, well, you know, the newspaper is more objective because it's less around a personality," or but then they'd go read Herb Cain, or you know, they would say, you know, I my mother, for example, will watch a specific channel where she lives because of the talent that they bring. Mm-hmm. Have any of your talents sort of leveraged their name in the way that you might see social media experts or so-called experts do the same thing kind of on the web, that have taken to the web and are worth following or noting?
Mm-hmm. You know, TV is a different medium than newspapers. And as you know, in 1996, I went from the Chronicle to TV. And initially, I was a little bit in denial about the differences. You know, I thought news is news, and a newsroom's a newsroom, and, you know, I need people who are good at sourcing and good at writing and good at reporting. And I would interview reporters, and they'd for seeking jobs, and they'd say, "What are you looking for?" And I'd say, "Somebody who can break stories and who can get good sources." And they'd say, "Yeah, but what about performance?" And I was kind of in denial that performance was anything really worth talking about. But the reality is that we are a visual and auditory medium, and we play out differently than ink on a page. So if you're not comfortable talking to a camera, this isn't a medium that's suitable for you. And how people talk to cameras and how they come across through cameras is a real factor in television, and ought to be a real factor in television, and it's not something that you can just dissolve away. That doesn't mean that you need to perpetuate the stereotype of, you know, the classic blow-dried anchor, lousy journalist stereotype. Which I don't think fits people on television in the Bay Area. The people I know who are on air and TV are experienced, smart journalists who've been around. A lot of them have worked in different media, and they've worked at a lot of different stations, and they know how to go out and tell stories, and they know the history of the Bay Area, and they know the issues in the news. But there is that stereotype, and unfortunately it fits in TV stations in some places. Not so much here. What we've tried to do in terms of social media focuses less on our on-air talent and more on the station as a whole, so that CBS5.com, and this is something that really we've developed only in the last year, we have a Twitter account, we have a Facebook page, and we're starting to attract a significant following, and it's interesting because from an interactive standpoint, it works in a lot of different ways, not the least of which is sourcing. We find we can go to our Twitter page and ask people, you know, if we need to find a, you know, middle-aged man who's been laid off from a job as a blue-collar worker in the South Bay, we can ask our Twitter followers for that, and 9 times out of 10, they'll say, "Sure, here's the names of some people you can talk to." So it's a terrific opportunity for sourcing as well as for interacting with our viewers and for creating a newsroom that I hope is a little bit more transparent. We do a lot of stuff in an attempt to let people see into the process of making the news here, so it's less of a mystery. I think and I don't mean to babble on about this, but one of the problems traditional media have had is that they're very opaque. You know, we work in these big buildings, and we have reflecting glass on the windows, and we have guards downstairs, and so you can't get in, and if you make a phone call, you get a phone tree and can't reach a human being, and nobody answers your emails. And so it's no wonder that people sometimes wonder if there's some conspiratorial little group plotting what stories go on the news in order to further some strange political agenda. So I think we do better if we are more transparent and also more responsive. So one thing I've done is just made it a policy in our newsroom that unless an email or a letter is, you know, just abusive and ridiculous, we answer them, including critical ones. We answer every single one. When people call in with a comment or want information or say, why do you have that anchor doing that? Or why did you lead with that story? Or why did you show that terrible picture? We answer them. We answer them to the best of our abilities, including saying, we're not sure we did the right thing. It seemed like the right thing to do at the time. We're looking at it. And it's amazing. Sometimes people will write and say, I hate that you do such and such and such. And I'll write back and say, well, I disagree. Here's why we do it. And the answer will be, I still think you're wrong, but I'm so pleased and impressed that you took the trouble to get back to me. So, you know, we try to be more responsive, and then adding the Twitter page and the Facebook page have helped us with that. Then about a year and a half ago, or maybe it's been 2 years now, we hired a blogger called Brittany Gilbert, who does a blog called Ion Blogs, and she's really a blog aggregator. What she does is blog about all the blogs in the Bay Area. And so it's a place you can go to. Her blog is a place you can go to see what different bloggers in the Bay Area are talking about. It's almost an index to Bay Area blogs. And that's worked really well for us. It got off to kind of a slow start. This is a very sophisticated market in terms of social media and blogging. And
I don't think anybody would disagree with you there.
So Brittany showed up, and she didn't exactly catch fire right away. I think people were going down many different roads and had many things to do and weren't particularly immediately concerned with what this new blogger at Channel 5 was doing, but she's really caught on. And we've had social events for other bloggers here at the station, and I think the blogging community appreciates, I don't know that one can generalize about the blogging community, but I think many bloggers appreciate the references that they get in her column, in her blog/column. And there's a back and forth, and that's starting to attract a really significant amount of traffic. And then the other thing I'd mention is we do a thing online called Brian's Daily Briefing, and Brian's Daily Briefing is a little report that our assignment editor does that we record on video every morning after our morning news meeting, and it's basically, here's what we're working on today. And when we launched it, a lot of people said, you're crazy. You know, the only people who are going to watch it are the assignment editors at Channel 7 and Channel 11 and Channel 2 because they want to know what you're working on so they can match it. And our view was, if they have nothing better to do than to watch what stories we're doing and learn about them an hour and a half after we've decided and to try to catch up to us and do the same story, they're not going to succeed. So we can lay it out there. And there, sometimes if we have some really hot investigative piece, Brian won't talk about it. But typically he says, here's what we're doing, and here's why, and here's how, and here's what we hope to get. And he's not an on-air talent. He's very talented performing in front of a camera, but he's the guy who runs our assignment desk.
Which, for those that don't know, is sort of like the pulse of everything happening.
It's the nerve center of the newsroom.
Yeah,
and Brian
absolutely.
Brian's the assignment manager, and he's an outstanding journalist who's been with us for a long time. And before he was here, he was in radio at KGO. And that's the place where we listen to the scanners, and we watch what comes in the wires, and the reporters call into, and the photographers call into, and we dispatch them out of. And when news breaks, he lets us know. In fact, he's even got a bell on his desk to let us know, an old analog tool. So Brian does kind of a shtick, but it's got a substantive undertone, which is, here's what we're doing, and you can see, and here's our thought process and why we're doing it, and just another little way of looking into the process.
So we should say that you're at twitter.com/CBS5, the number 5. Right now the current tweet is, want a new kitty friend, a man in Sacramento is trying to give away his 100 cats. But most of the pieces that, you know, most of the tweets that you have here are really actually raw footage, which I think is fantastic. You have some breaking, a few breaking news alerts from the week. Clearly, lots and lots of tweeting going on. But one of my favorite from this week is Gmail is down, commence panicking. So nice little...
That's how a lot
nice
of people
little,
felt, I think.
Yeah, a nice little nod to the kind of state of the state of affairs these days.
Stephanie what John, who's a longtime show producer and special projects producer here, is the principal animator behind our tweets. And you know, it's some combination of lighthearted stuff that's appropriate to a social medium that's not. It's not a 30-minute newscast. inside stuff about us. Requests for information, sharing information, breaking news. It's kind of an amalgam. And she and we play with it a lot and talk about whether it is what it ought to be. But it seems to be getting a good response and a growing number of followers. And the Facebook, which is newer, the Facebook page is really more of an attempt to show us as we are. And it's got a lot of little anecdotal information about the newsroom when Nancy Pelosi came by here and forgot her wallet, and we tracked her down and got it to her. And
well, thank goodness.
Information, but you know, it was up on Facebook right away, and there's a fair amount in there of somebody in the, you know, personalities of people in the newsroom, and just it's a way to give a little bit better sense of who we are. For those who might care.
Yeah, I think that you guys are using social media actually really fantastically. But as I said, my precursor to that is that you've been doing this, you've been monitoring it for a very long time. And as you mentioned earlier, you invest time for your staff and yourself in training so that you have at least a surface level understanding or a 30,000 foot view of, you know, kind of where to resource things and how, you know, what trends might be occurring and, you know, helping to identify whether those are long-term trends or short-term trends so you can staff appropriately. One of the plays that you made early on in social media, or I don't even know if you'd call it social media, but in a media form that I think a lot of us love and are looking at is mobile. And I wanted to ask you, before we got too far, where your mobile effort is right now, because you did have an early mobile effort, and it's been an impressive one. Where is it now?
You know, right now our mobile effort is being re-engineered, and it's being re-engineered by the gurus for our web efforts in New York. And we're about to launch a mobile app for iPods, for iMacs, and but we'll have, I think, probably a significant mobile announcement to make in the next month or two. But right now, we've been undergoing a reappraisal, and it is in development.
Very cool. Well, that's something to look for. One thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is that having worked, you're an owned and operated by CBS station. And with, you know, sort of the headquarters for CBS Interactive being at CNET now, so being, you know, not too far away from your own building, has that led to any kind of, you know, either – you know, light or serious competition on some of the tech stories that are coming either out of the Silicon Valley or within San Francisco itself?
Well, I think it's led to cooperation more than competition. I think it gives us a tremendous opportunity on a number of levels. For one thing, CBS Interactive and CNET have launched a new section, if you will, called Money Watch. Which is a personal finance section and kind of takes the place of CBS Market Watch, which, as you know, was sold to Dow Jones a couple of years ago. And Money Watch is being picked up on the network website. It will be picked up on our website. It's being picked up on CBS Radio. And so there's certainly a synergy there for traditional broadcast with CNET. CNET also works closely with the television group, and that's the group of stations that are owned and operated by CBS, ourselves included, on news coverage projects. They do a series of stories called Tech Minutes, which are sent out every week, which we air in our news on the weekend. They work with us on covering various events. For example, Brian Cooley, I think, who is one of their reporters, will be covering the Apple announcement next week.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll be doing that for CNET. And he's a terrific reporter, and he's been on our air a lot. He comes on our morning news quite a lot. But he'll also be doing live coverage and tape packages for the CBS television station group. So there have been a number of opportunities for cooperation with CNET in the years since they were acquired, and we talk a lot to them about ways that we can do more, and I think there will be more between us as we go forward. So we're really more I can't tell you what competitive feelings may exist between individuals on the two staffs, but I think the approach we're going to take is they're a tremendous new resource for us. Both CNET and the other sites that they operate, Chow, which is a food site, as you know. And BNet, which is a business news site.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of what they do is quite specialized and more suitable to the web than to a broad audience television show. But they bring great expertise and ability, and we think they can have produced and will produce more good content that we can use in our newscasts. And maybe we can provide something of value back to them.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what do you lend to them? Because certainly you, a lot of their web reporting doesn't have sort of the earlier piece you discussed. You know, how did it look?
Right. Well, I think one thing we give them is a platform to get their name out. If we have CNET reporters on our air who do a good job, that just makes CNET more appealing to a broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's an opportunity for us to add quality content to broadcast news and make CNET and BNet and Chow better known so that more people will go to their websites, more than it is an opportunity right now for us to supply a lot of content to their websites, although there may be chances to do that as well down the road.
Looking, kind of on a different note, looking at, your station overall, what do you feel like is your unique selling point? And I'll leave it at that, whether, whatever channel it may be, whether it's on air, online, what do you feel like CBS 5 brings to the local market?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. One is, when I first came to TV from newspapers, one of the words I heard a lot was differentiation. And everybody in the TV business talked about how it was really important for TV news stations to differentiate themselves from each other. And you'd hear the word all the time, but you saw precious little of it in practice. You know, if you looked at Channel 7 News, Channel 2 News, Channel 5 News, they essentially look very much alike.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things that we are trying very hard to do here right now is to define ourselves as a television station that gets beyond all the same stories that everybody else does, and gets beyond the tradition of a lot of local television stations, which is, let's do the video version tonight of the story that was in the newspaper this morning. And become instead a station that uses the powerful tools of sound and pictures to tell stories that we discover that are hard-edged, that really will help define the news agenda for the Bay Area. So we put a tremendous emphasis on enterprise reporting and on finding new angles and new dimensions to stories that are either undiscovered or underreported, or that have been widely reported but that need to be spun forward, and new dimensions of those stories need to be discovered and found. And that's something I think that we do that we take a lot of pride in, and that I think sets us apart. Obviously, all the TV stations, the price of admission is, on some level, the news of the day, and certainly it's the coverage of breaking news. And our audience spikes when there's breaking news.
Sure.
If the Bay Bridge shuts down, if a refinery catches on fire, if there's a high-profile story that's happening now, people still tune in droves because there's really nowhere else to go to get live pictures and sound, high-quality live pictures and sound of an event that's presented in an ongoing and consistent way. You may find a clip here or there on the web, but there's nobody else out there that's got an army of photographers and reporters who can go out with satellite trucks, microwave trucks, get signals back and put them on the air and sustain them over a period of time. So we do very well with breaking news, and it's very important. But that's really the price of admission. Beyond that, I think, is the question is, what do you give me day to day that makes it worthwhile for me to tune in for 30 minutes at 5 o'clock or an hour at 6 o'clock or a half an hour at 11 o'clock? And, yeah, I want to come away from your newscast knowing that the basic facts weren't ignored, but those basic facts often can be presented by an anchor in a 20-second introduction or a 20-second voiceover or a 40-second voiceover with a soundbite in it. But in terms of how we use our precious reporter resources, and there's only time for a limited number of reporter packages, longer stories in a 30-minute broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
Once you take out the weather and you take out the sports and you take out the commercials and you take out the headlines, you're only looking at 4 or 5 packages in a 30-minute broadcast. What are you going to do with those where you take a little bit more time to tell the story? And there, I think, we try to find those things that people will say, that was really interesting, or that was really useful, or I learned something, or I kind of knew that all along, but I didn't realize I know it, and now I have a clearer understanding of it, or they moved the ball forward, or now I have a better sense of what's going to happen tomorrow. Really take a more enterprising approach to local news. Local news is our core strength. We're not a network. Obviously, we produce some material that we get. We broadcast some material that we get from CBS Network and from other national and international sources. But our core competency, if you will, is local news. This is where we have our reporting staff. This is where we have our collective memory and our knowledge. And this is what we have a tremendous news gathering organization that the big cable stations don't have, for example, and that the websites don't have, because primarily the websites up to now have been aggregators.
Right.
You know, the Yahoos of the world are aggregators of other people's content, including our content, because we sell them some.
Yeah, and Google as well.
Yeah.
Which makes
Go ahead.
No, you were going to say something about Google.
Well, no, I was actually going to take another tack, which is, you know, you mentioned the training thing.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that's changing in our business, as it is everywhere else, is the technology. We're a digital business now, and we do nonlinear editing, and we have these wonderful lightweight cameras that cost a couple $1,000s instead of $40,000 and weigh 6 pounds instead of 45 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
And we have digital microwave that we can put on a small vehicle rather than having to have a big truck with a tall mast. And so we are able to be, the technology exists for us to be much more flexible. And along with that, I think, develops the need for us to have a staff that's more flexible. And just as, you know, jobs change over time, it's kind of like, you know, if you think of the change from craft unionism to industrial unionism, the old AFL of the 19th mm-hmm. century, you had everybody was very narrowly defined as a steam fitter or a boiler maker or a pipe fitter. And then, not that those jobs totally went away, but they were replaced, the categories were replaced by kind of the one big union concept, the United Auto Workers, or you're a steel worker, regardless of what you do. And a little bit in television, the tradition was, you're a photographer, or you're an editor, or you're a tech, or you're a reporter, or you're a writer, or you're a producer, and those lines are starting to break down. And people are learning and having to learn to do multiple things. And it's not that we no longer value the skill set, and it's not that there will no longer be some people who specialize in certain areas because they're really good photographers or they're really good at talking on camera. It's that by and large, we need more members of our new staff who can go out with a lightweight camera and do different things, who can go out and shoot video, who know how to write about what they saw, who know how to talk about what they saw, who know how to edit that video. And so our photographers are getting some training in writing and in performing. And our on-air reporters are getting some training in shooting video and in editing. And that's a wrenching change. It's a cultural change. It's a hard change for people to accept. We have an old established news organization that has certain ways of doing business. There are issues with our organized labor contracts, which define jurisdictions and define jobs certain ways that have to be renegotiated. But I think everyone realizes, the managers, the staff, the union leadership realizes that we are going to need to change. The devil's in the details. We need to figure out a way to do it that's fair and that's humane and that's reasonable and that sustains the quality of, or raises the quality and the value of what we provide to our viewers and users. But we do need to change. We can't play a pat hand as the pie shrinks. We need to find a way to be faster and more nimble and more efficient and better at the same time. And that's kind of the process that we're involved in now, right now here.
And I think that's not unlike a lot of businesses right now. That's the, when I come in as a consultant, that's often the word I use, nimble. You have to be nimble, and sort of break down the barriers in your own mind first so that you can really get to the, you know, the meaty piece of all of this.
Right.
And having said that, you know, I really wonder, what is kind of the thing you're most proud of in your tenure at KPIX or CBS 5?
Oh, boy, it's hard to point to a single thing. I'm really proud of the people who work here. I that sounds kind of trite, but this is, you know, I always say you can, you know, you can scare somebody into coming to work in the morning and punching a clock and doing them, you know, the minimum that's required and punching a clock and going home because they got to have the job and they got to have the paycheck. But the trick is to have a staff that wants to open veins every day and do way more than is asked of them and or than is required of them and cares about the craft and cares about the business that they're in and cares about the quality of what they do. And I'm so proud to be, as I say, it sounds corny, but I'm so proud to be working with a group of professionals who care so much about the news and about doing it right. And we go out and we fall short and we make mistakes and we self-recriminate and critique and figure out what we did wrong and try and do it better. But just a wonderful group of people here, and I'm proud to be associated with them.
And I know,
and I would point to that more than any single news event. Obviously, I'm proud anytime I think we do something well, that we do a meaningful story, we raise some unpopular issue and look at it. I was proud of our coverage after 9/11 and how we talked about the issues surrounding Islam and Muslims in this country. I'm proud of our coverage of breaking news. I'm proud of the enterprise work that we do. I'm proud of, but really it comes down to the staff. They're the people who do it. And they make me proud. How about that?
That's pretty awesome. Not many bosses say that, especially
lucky.
Given that you've added an investigative unit since you've been there. Not that, what, maybe 5 years ago now?
Well, I was lucky. I mean, I got here in 2000, and that was a time when the fortunes of CBS were starting to pick up in prime time. You know, they had a hit show called Survivor. You might remember that. So they were starting to get some eyeballs and starting to get some younger eyeballs. And at that point, the network said, the company said, we have an opportunity. We're getting a prime time audience. We need to get these people into our newscasts. And so we need to rejuvenate our newscasts. So they were willing to spend some money when I came here, and we were able to expand the staff and add general assignment reporters and photographers and some producers, and we added weekend morning news, which hadn't been done here before. And we hired a doctor, Kim Mulvihill, and we hired an investigative reporter, Anna Werner, and Sue Kwan came over to do consumer. And we expanded the oversight staff and beefed up just about every area of the newsroom. And in the last few years, things have been much harder from a resource point of view. And as I mentioned, we let some people go. But we've been able to hold on to, you know, those key areas that I think also set us apart. I think beats are really important, and a lot of TV stations don't do beats because you don't have enough reporters.
Mm-hmm.
But we dedicate a reporter full-time to covering the environment, and I'm proud of that and of the job we do, and it's a topic that I think really resonates with people in the Bay Area. They care a lot about, you know, the quality of life, the quality of the water, and the quality of the air, and so we invest in that, and we invest full-time in somebody who does consumer and money and in medical and an investigative. And the investigative unit is not just the person you see on air, but it's also a talented group of photographers and producers who work with Anna to kind of dig below the surface and find those things that aren't that easy and take a little bit more time, but that I think is one of the reasons journalism exists, is because people need to know these things. They need to know when things aren't working right. They're not.
It's supposed to be about the public interest, isn't it?
Supposedly, yeah, and about accountability, I think.
Absolutely. Well, Dan, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I thank you so much for coming on, because I think you're certainly one of the newsmen to be respected and known in the Bay Area market, not only because you have been around the block and you know the market well, but because, as I said, I think, you know, the couple of times that I've met you, you've certainly displayed this innate ability to really figure out and not be scared of change, but instead embrace it and go, what's this about, in sort of a matter-of-fact way. And I think that's so, so important, and will in the end probably help all of our interests from a news point of view moving forward rather than fear. So I thank you,
Jennifer,
for joining us on the show.
Jennifer, you're very nice. I'm not sure any of those kind words are really true, but I'm happy to hear them. And
well,
I thank you for that. Thanks for the opportunity.
Anybody who thinks their staff, you know, is a good guy anyway. So.
Well, thanks for letting me come on and gab a little bit with you, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate
good luck
it.
To you. Okay,
thanks.
Bye.
And I want to thank all of the audience for tuning in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Remember to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. And also be sure to tune in next week when our featured guest is Luc Lemieux, founder of Seismic and Le Web Conference. That's 1 week from today at noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show, archives, and free informational webcasts at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend. Enjoy the long holiday.